We're going to begin right in your consciousness. Not outside yourself. And we're walking out of Jerusalem, which is a traditional state of orthodoxy, a belief in a God external to ourselves, and we're walking away from Jerusalem. And now we're walking over a brook. It's called the Brook of Cedron. And as we walk over the brook, we notice that the waters are rather murky. The waters of this brook represent the clutter and the confusion of the world mind that we're walking over. And we come to the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives stands for the love of God that we entertain within ourselves. When we mount the western slope of the Mount of Olives, we come to a little shaded park, a garden called Gethsemane. And we have made a journey in consciousness from orthodoxy over mortal mind, guided and led by love of God to this inner sanctuary in the Mount of Olives called Gethsemane, which is the place, the arena, where we are ready for the supreme test. Here, the forces of the world, which have dominated humanity, are going to meet in us the awareness of identity. And here, identity stands, letting the forces of the world explode as they will, and identity says, I need no defense against nothing. This supreme test in Gethsemane is that arena of consciousness in which we reach the peak of all of our activity, building the spiritual consciousness to the point where we are ready now to let the old man die. We're ready to accept the allness of God, the one power of God, the incorporeality of reality. We're ready to accept that spirit is and matter is not. And in this place, this secret place, we are prepared to meet any adversary, regardless of its name or nature or whatever disguise it may wear, because we have learned now that there are no adversaries at all. They are all the disguises of the world mind. They are never real. They have no substance. They are not God created or sustained. Here in Gethsemane, we are prepared to face what the world fears, knowing the illusory nature of it. Here we stand knowing the truth, being the truth. Here we say, I am the life itself. Here we need no sword. Here we need no offense. Here we need nothing to protect ourselves, nothing to run away from, nothing to fear, nothing to change. Gethsemane is where Christ in you is born. This is where the real crucifixion takes place. You crucify the world mind in Gethsemane. You suffer the agonies that the world thinks you're suffering, but to you, they are the ecstasy of knowing the truth of being. Everyone is moving toward Gethsemane. Every day you have been experiencing the dying of the unreal, that within you you may become conscious of the real. And every true disciple finally comes to the place where, unarmed and undefended, he takes dominion over the world, alone, without any human aid. merely by being being. Now you know that many changes are taking place in your life at this time. Many have reported to me that quite a number of changes are taking place in their lives, and I've never seen such an increased amount of change in our students, in the outer world of effects. New jobs, new homes, new relationships, promotions, going to new cities, new understanding. All of this is the outer revealing the new activity within. And if there is no change going on in your outer, it is because your inner is stagnant. Always the outer will reflect the inner change. And because we at the moment have been in a great inner change in this work, everywhere it seems I receive phone calls and letters about people who say this is happening and that is happening. There's quite a great deal of happy excitement about it. It's a sort of a yardstick to measure how we have progressed within. And now another progression. The Master has made his talk from the Last Supper until this moment. The disciples have been exposed to the highest truth on the earth. How much they have absorbed remains to be seen. How much we have absorbed remains to be seen. Because when we read about the disciples, the Master, Gethsemane, this isn't because we're interested in history. We're here to extract the message of today out of the words that appeared yesterday, knowing they are now words, a now message. They are to guide us this moment. We are to make them ours. And so we join this little group of early disciples, but we're really watching ourselves in a figure called Christ Jesus, and ourselves in other figures called disciples, who are the full divine qualities of God, invisible, coming into visibility through the careful cultivation of the Christ within. All of this is us. All of this is happening within each individual here, all the time. And we are given this externalized picture so that we may find that which only spiritual consciousness can reveal, even before we have developed that spiritual consciousness. And so we see Gethsemane as the Christ mind. We see the brook as the world thoughts that we pass through to come to the Christ mind. We see the Mount of Olives, where love is the law. And we know that Gethsemane means, it's formed of two words. The geth is actually gath, and that is an oil press. A press. They took the olives from the trees and pressed them to get the oil in the press. And the shemen, which became simani, is the oil. You press out the oil from the olive. And oil is a symbol of the wisdom, the divine understanding. And there's Gethsemane, the place where the olives are pressed for the oil to be distilled. Gethsemane, the place where the world is pressed out of you. And in the pain, in the so-called suffering, we find that out of our pain is pressed the wisdom of the Father. You remember the first series of temptations, just coming out of the wilderness. Those were the temptations of power and of pleasure. Now in Gethsemane,
The second series of temptations are the temptations of pain and of sorrow, of bodily harm, of life being torn away. Another series of temptations, and there will still be another series later. And so these are the temptations we are alerted to be prepared for. And now let's follow this little band, remembering this is all happening in your consciousness, whether you're conscious of it or not. And it is being externalized to show you that you too must travel over the brook, up the Mount of Olives, the Mount of Love, to the garden, which would seem to be a garden of sorrows, but it unbars the gates to glory. This garden now, this Gethsemane, is the sacred place of the Most High. Within you it is the oasis of truth, where you are prepared to meet all that is untrue, knowing it has no place. Here you will meet the serpent, but unlike Adam, you will not be fooled. Here you will be given an opportunity to accept the tree of life or the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And because you are not the first Adam, but the second, coming into Christ, we learn here to look at the serpent, Judas, to look at good and evil, the attackers, the world of effects around us, the threat of powers. And instead of succumbing as Adam did, we overcome the temptation. We do not overcome our enemies. We overcome the temptation to accept that there are enemies in the garden of truth within your consciousness. Our Gethsemane is meeting the temptation to believe that humanhood is there. Watch how subtly the Spirit leads us. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the brook, Cedron, where was a garden, into which he entered and his disciples. Cedron you'll find in the Old Testament too. It's spelled there K-I-D-R-O-N, and here it's C-E-D-R-O-N. In both places it means mortal mind. David fled over the brook of Kidron when he was fleeing from Absalom. And in 1 Kings there's something about Kidron in reference to Solomon. But now it's coming into clearer focus because we know exactly what the disciples are doing. They're stepping out of mortal mind. They're walking with the Master out of mortal mind, out of world mind, out of hypnosis, out of material consciousness. An historical truth about this brook is interesting. It actually empties out into the Dead Sea, a sort of a forerunner of where the truth would ultimately be found, as it was in the parchments found in the Dead Sea. And now we learn too that Gethsemane was a headquarters for Jesus and his group. Even after he long departed, it remained a headquarters for Mary and John and other disciples. They all came to this high mount for the meditative periods when they were opened to the infinite. Whenever Jesus and his group came to Jerusalem or Bethany, rather than go directly into the temples, they pitched tents here. They rested. It was their favorite spot for regeneration. And yet, even though it's an outer spot, a physical spot on a map, it's the inner spot that we all find, that place where we rest for regeneration. And this signifies now that we're coming to that place where we are to meet the divine word within ourselves, instead of the world thought of the brook of Kidron. We cross over that brook. Love draws us that very Mount of Olives where the Sermon on the Mount was delivered, another sermon of love. And here we rest now inside ourselves. We have passed out of a false consciousness, a consciousness which sees evil where only the kingdom of perfection is. In Gethsemane, we are not in the false consciousness. And yet still, there are two Gethsemanes. There is the spiritual Gethsemane and the physical. And if we only go into the physical Gethsemane, we're still going to see evil. We, dwelling in the secret place, go to the spiritual Gethsemane, where there is only one life, one invisible, everywhere, infinite being, life itself, that I am. Our spiritual Gethsemane is the realization of oneness. And now, if you're prepared to rest there, it won't matter if Judas comes. Judas is on the way, we know. What is not reported in the Bible is that coming to Gethsemane for Jesus was the second stop along the way. The first was in Mark's mother's house. That's where Judas thought they were. That's where he left them. That's where he received the sop. He got his little band of soldiers. He wanted to make quick work of this. He made the arrangements with the Romans. He was going to lead them. He made the arrangement with the Sanhedrin. He was going to lead them. And so he got his little band together. They went to Mark's mother's house. It was going to be very quick because nobody was armed except Simon Peter and Simon the Zealot, just two men. The rest would have no way of counteracting this quick maneuver. And in the quiet of the evening, when the city was asleep, Jesus would be taken without any great tumult. Who was this Judas doing this? He was our corporeal sense. He had been dismissed, but like the serpent, he was still ready to come back. To his surprise, the little band wasn't there. He thought to himself, now what am I going to do? They've probably gone to their favorite headquarters, Gethsemane. And so now he had to do something different, because whereas in the first time he was going to just take a little band, he knew that in Gethsemane many people came to visit Jesus. This was where he often entertained Nicodemus and even other members of the Sanhedrin who privately came for instruction. This was where sufferers came for deliverance. This was where the world came to Jesus. Just as you and I must come to Gethsemane frequently within ourselves, it is there that you find your twin. If you've been trying to find your twin, you'll find your twin in Gethsemane. That is where the invisible Christ resides. Only in that consciousness, where there is nothing to defend against or to fear, where there is only one, where there is no second, that's where you find Christ. Judas now had to get a little larger group together. And so now it is even rumored that he awakened Pilate in the night and said, we need some Roman soldiers. And now they had a larger garrison because they knew there was a larger group waiting in Gethsemane for them. They didn't know what to expect, how many people were armed. The Greeks had by now joined Jesus and his group in Gethsemane too. It was a large park, you see. Now it isn't known, but Jesus was waiting for them, and not with his group. He was all alone. He actually went and sat on an olive press, and he waited. And his reason was, he knew they were coming, and he wanted as little activity there. He wanted no opportunity for his group to in any way resist. He was all alone, waiting. Meanwhile, here's Judas with a prearranged idea that I will kiss the man you are to take, because, of course, the Roman soldiers knew very little about who Jesus might be. The Sanhedrin soldiers did. The guards of the temple did. But to be sure that he was identified properly, the prearranged signal was a kiss. And even then, Judas was very cunning. He walked well in advance of his crew. He hoped within himself that he could be so far in advance of them that his former colleagues would think that he was coming to warn them, that he wasn't connected with this group but was running ahead of them to warn them. But it didn't work out that way at all. And now we come to some interesting things here, little subtleties that are important. We find Judas leading the pack. Judas also, which betrayed him, knew the place. For Jesus oft-times resorted thither with his disciples. Having gone to Gethsemane with Jesus and the disciples before many times, it was natural for Judas to know that because he wasn't at Mark's mother's house, he was here. And now he was on his way. Judas then, having received a band of men and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, cometh thither with lanterns and torches and weapons. Did you notice that he received his weapons from the chief priests? In Matthew we're told those weapons were swords and staves. He received them from the chief priests, those great lovers of God. Gave him weapons to take the Christ. And this is telling us that corporeality in us, which Judas symbolizes, will always attack the Christ of you and even think it is doing a holy thing. This is a great statement about the betrayal of the church. That not knowing the invisible Christ, it attacks the Christ. That world mind, not knowing incorporeal truth, attacks the truth. And these human methods, the lanterns, the torches, would indicate they are coming at night, which is a state of darkness, a lack of spiritual discernment. In their state of darkness, they are coming to attack the Christ. The lantern would refer to the intellect, the torches to the reason. Human aids, human weapons, and all under the guise of authority. So does mortal mind come to us disguised as religious, political, and forceful authority by might and by power, in some way ever attempting to stifle the spirit. All this is within us. It's not outer. The reason, the intellect, the human sense of righteousness, the human sense of what is the correct way to do things, comes with lanterns and with torches, with a letter of truth, with human weapons, saying we are doing the right thing, weapons given by the priesthood. And what is the great crime that they are attacking? In the visible world, The only crime they are attacking is that the man has done good. That's the crime. The man has done good. What harm has the man done? Nothing but help, nothing but love. And so we can't have any of that, says corporeality. That's in our way. Corporeality wants to manipulate and convert everything to its own selfish interest. Don't make the mistake of thinking these are Pharisees and soldiers with lamps and lanterns and torches and weapons. These are the corporeal disciples within ourselves. These are the disciples of world mind within us attacking Christ. And they are led by Judas, the serpent in the garden. And who is Judas? Our own physical form. Your own physical form leads the attack and bands all of the rest of its own disciples together to make the attack sure to succeed. You're being told here that the greatest betrayer of your true selfhood is your sense of body and your sense of mind. For it cannot see the invisible Christ and therefore ignores or attacks that which it cannot see. This is the false consciousness of humanity that is being described as Judas coming with a band armed with weapons and with lanterns and torches. This is the false consciousness of each individual human being. The consciousness we're going to meet in Gethsemane and overcome. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that should come upon him, went forth and said unto them, Whom seek ye? This great act of compassion has been unnoticed before. The purpose of it was to prevent Judas from making the betrayal. For Judas's sake. He hadn't yet kissed Jesus Christ, the kiss of death. And so to save him the trouble of making himself into a visible betrayer, the Master said to those who came, Whom seek ye? He was going to give himself up rather than let Judas be a betrayer. But of course there's deeper meaning there. Way back at the beginning of his discipleship, when he picked those who would follow him, he said, What seek ye? When Andrew came and John came, what seek ye? Well, they said, we seek where thou livest. And of course the meaning, though they weren't quite aware of their meaning, the words were placed within them. The meaning was, we seek where Christ is, where Christ lives. And that should be always the quest, to seek where Christ lives, because Christ lives within you. And if that's your quest and you find Christ within you, you'll find the living kingdom of God. But to these men he now says, Whom seek ye? It's the other side of the same question. To the disciples, the answer would become, We seek the Christ. But to those who are not disciples, they don't answer, We seek where thou livest. They're not seeking Christ. He's pointing out the difference between a disciple and an undisciple. These seek Jesus of Nazareth. They're not looking for Christ. They're looking for a man, a form, a corporeal creature. That's what they came to find. That's what the lanterns were for, and the torches, so they could see and get the right man. But they were looking at Christ and seeing a man. They were looking at the Spirit of God and seeing a man. They were looking at their own self and seeing another form. They were blind, as mankind is, to its own self. They were attacking their own self. The absurdity of the attack is that we are doing it every day. Each day, with lanterns and torches, led by Judas, we corporeally attack our own self. Whom seek ye? We seek, they said, Jesus of Nazareth. Each day when we identify ourselves as person, we are committing the same folly. We say that we are person, mortal being, a human self, a Jesus of Nazareth or a Mary of Alameda, or a John of Palo Alto. We identify ourselves as the person, as they did in seeking the one they would crucify. They were seeking a form. Actually, they were seeking a deadness, because there was no self there other than the living Christ. So do we act out of deadness in mortality. Now, you would expect the disciples, of course, to know better. He doesn't correct those who come to take him away. Fine, you're looking for Jesus of Nazareth, that's fine. I am he. And of course, there's the double statement again. Just like render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God that which is God's. I am he. To you who come to take me in the night, you only see Jesus of Nazareth. But I am he. I am the life of God. I am the invisible self, visible to your limited consciousness as Jesus of Nazareth. I am he, the eternal self, the infinite being, the one who was never born, who will never die, the one who with a snap of the fingers could dismiss every soldier who stood there. And while he was saying, I am he, not running from the soldiers, not defending, because Christ needs no defense, there was a bond of love established that they were unaware of. He who said, I am he, was love itself. And he who said, I am he, was the I am of those very soldiers who came to take him away. Love was recognizing self. Love was being self. There was only one self there to him who said, I am he. That's your Gethsemane. Standing in the midst of many, even under visible attack of form, I am he. And those who apparently are attacking me, can they be there if I am he who is the infinite self? Is there another here than I? I am he does not fall into the trap of form, matter, movement, humanhood, mortality. I am he knows only I am he, and knows no other is present. Divine love expresses as self-realization. And before the scene goes any further, we see the power of divine love. We see the power of truth and consciousness. We see the power of only identity as defense. What happens? The soldiers fall back. They are unable to do what they came to do. They have absolutely no power to move and take him. They cannot touch him. Why? Because there is only one divine consciousness present. There is no second consciousness. There is only the consciousness of I am he. The divided is gone. The second consciousness is gone. It cannot externalize as force, as power, as hate, as destruction. In the one divine consciousness present, I am he, we see what Gethsemane means. It means resting in our oneness, knowing only our oneness is present. There is no second, where I stand or where he stands or where she stands. One with God is all that is there, and therefore it is the majority. I am he is your answer to every problem you consider to be present in your complete and total environment in all ways. The problems that you experience are the externalization of that consciousness in you which is not I am he. That false consciousness shows forth as your problems, as those things which threaten the harmony of your being. So this is how we stand in Gethsemane. And we learn from this that the soldiers always fall back. Judas, which betrayed him, stood with them. The importance of that statement is that Judas wasn't standing with Jesus. Jesus Christ stood in I am he, and Judas stood with the soldiers. There was no Jesus and Judas standing together. There was no I am he and corporeality. I am he is the total absence of the belief in corporeality. The total awareness that there is no Judas. There is no force. There is no flesh. There is no matter. There is no other power. There is no activity. There is only the spirit present. Spirit alone is present, is I am he. And when you can stand on only spirit is present, you have found where to stand. You are ready for your real Gethsemane. Judas is over there, standing in the false consciousness, not in your consciousness of I am he here. Now this is the clear picture that we are to walk away with. If we do not, it is because we are still in the Peter consciousness. Peter should have known all this by now. But as he watched, there was a growing anger within him. He loved this man, Jesus. He said, "I will give my life for you." And the Master said, "Will you, Peter? Will you really?" The cock will crow three times before you deny me. He loved the man. Just as they came to attack the man, Peter loved the man. And there was no man. There was only I am he, the Spirit of God. And so in your Gethsemane, while you are standing resolutely against one side of your consciousness which says the problem is here, there is another side in your consciousness which wants to attack the problem. release you from the problem. That would be the good side against the bad side. But that's the tree of good and evil. There are no good sides and no bad sides. In your true consciousness, there's no love of matter that you need to preserve, and no fear of matter that you have to defend against. You are a spiritual being. And matter does not exist in the consciousness of I am He. Now, if it were not necessary to teach us, there would never have been a Garden of Gethsemane. The scene could have even stopped at this point. But we had to learn that even though Jesus Christ could stand there, free, protected, without any defense, that divine love was the only force he needed. We who are incapable at this point of living at that level, who still have an active Peter consciousness within us, something in us is then going to want to remove the attacker. And so Peter reaches for the sword, cuts off the ear of Malchus, and breaks in you the protection of the light. The moment you attack another creature, you break the law of love. That's the teaching at this point, the breaking of the law of love. And then you are open to attack. Then the problems can come in like a landslide. But if you do not break the law of love, you are under the protection of the invisible light of love. For there is nothing there to be protected against except the illusion that something else is there. Peter breaks both commandments, the first and the second. That impulse in us which would defend breaks the first commandment because it acknowledges something beside the Spirit of God. Acknowledge me in all thy ways. Heart, mind, and soul, acknowledge me, the Spirit of God. Don't acknowledge these attackers with lanterns. Don't acknowledge these false thoughts within you. Don't acknowledge the things of the world that seem to be attacking. The first commandment says, acknowledge the Spirit is present. I am He, and beside me there is no other. So Peter broke that. And because he broke that, he automatically broke the second. I am He was loving the neighbor, but Peter wasn't. Peter couldn't love the neighbor because the neighbor was attacking the one he loved. And Peter was a very practical man, a natural man, a materialist. Here he was, and an innocent man was being led off to death. What was he supposed to do, stand there and watch him? But he was in the false consciousness which saw an innocent man being led off to death. The so-called innocent man had already declared, I am the life. I have power over all flesh. I can come and I can go. Destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up again. Whom didst thou say I am, Peter? And even Peter had said the Christ, and now he had forgotten it. He didn't know what he had said or what it meant. Defend the Christ? That would be like standing there to defend God, wouldn't it? But we are the Christ. Why do we defend ourselves against anything? Because we think we're not the Christ. We're not the Spirit. Because we think the things that are threatening us are actually happening. So day by day, through truth in consciousness, through the awakening of the spirit, we are lifted higher and higher until the moment when we can enter across the brook, up the mountain of love to the sacred place, and know that whatever comes now will be an illusion of the senses. All that exists is the Spirit of God. You're in your daily Gethsemane, daily solidifying the truth of being, and watching the soldiers fall back, watching the non-power of what it seemed to be a power. Now this is what we should be proving to ourselves every day. As soon as he had said, "I am he," they went backward and they fell to the ground. Then again he turned, "Whom seek ye?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Now between those two questions, Jesus had been kissed by Judas. Judas, not taking advantage of the love that was giving him an opportunity not to make the betrayal, presented the kiss, identifying Jesus as the one they were to take. And again, though, he emphasizes, "Whom do you seek?" To emphasize that they are seeking a man, a person. Now, in our human lives, we are seeking things. Just as they were seeking a form, we are seeking forms. And our mistake is that we are reaching out for that which is not there, although we can feel it and touch it and put it in our pocket and put it in our bank and put it in our homes. This is what we are seeking, forms. And we are fooling ourselves. The forms aren't there. You can get all of them you want, pile them up high. You can store them in barns. They are not there. They're not even perishable. They simply aren't there. For all that is there is the Spirit of God. This is to alert us to the non-reality of matter, no matter what form it may take. In Gethsemane, you live in the cause, and you let the effect of forms bombard against the cause in consciousness, and you stand there unperturbed, watching those soldiers fall to the ground. They are only the arm of flesh, but we know only the invisible living spirit. You see how Adam is dying and Christ is being born? The serpent is losing its sting. The tree of life is being selected instead of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The same writer who wrote Genesis, the same writer who wrote the complete Bible, wrote it from Genesis to Gethsemane, the Spirit of God. One writer. And only one actor, under many disguises called biblical characters. And all this, an outer expression of the inner conflict within every man. The conflict he doesn't even know is going on, to make it visible so that he becomes aware of this conflict and knows what to do and what is expected until we come to the purpose of our lives. It is to serve your own spirit. And when you're ready to serve only your spirit, to love your spirit supremely, you have found the complete purpose of everything that has happened up to this point. You have found the cup and the meaning of the cup. Peter's about to find the meaning of the cup. He strikes off the ear. John doesn't tell us that the master puts the ear back on. Maybe it wasn't necessary for us to know that. Or maybe he felt it would be carried on, it would be mentioned in the other Gospels. But basically he gives us what you don't find exactly the same way in the other Gospels. This Malchus, whose ear is struck off by Peter, is the bodyguard of the chief priest. The ear of this bodyguard is struck off. The ear of the servant of the priest is struck off. You see the symbolism? The ear struck off is a symbol of deafness. The priest is a symbol of the church. The deafness of religion, which is attacking the Christ. It has no ear. It cannot hear the inner word. It is deaf to Christ. It is deaf to God. It is deaf to spirit. It has an outer ear only to hear the letter. So the ear is struck off. And there's only one way for that ear to get back on to religion, so that it can hear. And that's why Jesus puts the ear back on. Only the Christ can restore the ear of the church. Until the church finds Christ, it has no ear. You see that? There is no listening capacity, no spiritual discernment, no receptivity until the church turns every member of every congregation to Christ within. Then it has an ear. And only when it has an ear can it obey the divine will. And so the removal of the ear from Malchus is the statement that religion has no ear for the divine word and is not obeying the divine will. And this is a current statement. These are the disciples here now. The ear of religion is not listening to Christ. It is coming with lanterns and torches. It is looking to make a better corporeal world. Whom seek ye? We seek to make better human beings, not spiritual reality. The church has not yet been to Gethsemane and isn't ready. And while we are not in Gethsemane, we are not listening to the word, but rather we are walking over the brook of Cedron, over the corruptible, turbid waters of human thought. Sometimes we fall right in. They're not the living waters of the inner I am He. Peter, put up thy sword unto thy sheath. I thought you were a disciple. Whom are you going to attack with that sword, Peter? Aren't you aware that this man over here, this soldier, is a mental image in your mind? Do you think there's a soldier there? Haven't you been learning about incorporeality? About the spirit which is all? You still think there's a soldier, Peter? Now we are all to be reprimanded, for we are all reaching for that sword every day. It may be the sword of words, the sword of plans, the sword of ambition, the sword of anticipation. We have so many swords in our scabbard. And we need none, for I am He. Put up thy sword unto thy sheath. We are learning there is an effortless way to live in the kingdom of God not by might or by power, but by my spirit. But if the damage is done, if you still believe in corporeality, if you still take out the sword, lo and behold, the soldiers who had fallen back, who had no power to attack, now they have the power. You're in division again. You're in duality again. It externalizes as a pro and a con. Adversaries are you and someone else, matter and the spirit. This world. Now, if that's clear to us, then we are being alerted to the real test of living in the spirit. Must I not drink the cup that my Father gave me, says the Master. What is this cup? You're going to have to drink it. You might as well know what's in it. We must all drink the cup that the Father gives us. Usually the cup refers to its contents. The cup, he could have said, well, this certainly can't be the will of God that I let them take me away to die. And so he said in another place in the Bible, take this cup from me. But then came the realization, but this cup is my will. This is what you're to do. Nevertheless, he said then, thy will, not mine. And so now he says, I must drink the cup my Father gave me. He didn't say it isn't the Father's will that I should die. He could have. No one would have in any way said anything bad about it. In fact, most people would have agreed. Certainly he shouldn't die. It's not the Father's will. But the cup you must drink is not to die. That wasn't the cup he was drinking. The cup he had to drink was to be exposed to the threat of death, to the temptation that death is reality. That was the content of the cup, temptation. In the cup that you must drink is the temptation to believe and to accept that you are a human being. The cup he had to drink was to drink it to the very bottom, to not accept the temptation that he was a human being. And because he is the way shower, ultimately you must drink that same cup. He said as much. He said to his disciples, you must walk with me in my temptations. To him who walks with me in my temptations, I give the kingdom. You must walk through the temptation that you are human, even to the point of a threat on your life. That is the cup we must drink. Each must be brought to that total understanding that I am not this human form. In Gethsemane, you meet that temptation. In Gethsemane, that is the end of the conflict between the matter and the spirit. And when you have ended that conflict by the total steadfastness to the truth of your being, you have passed the test of Gethsemane. That means if somebody comes in with a revolver to shoot you and you don't want to defend your life, you're doing a good job of knowing the truth in Gethsemane. That means if the doctor says you're going to die, you stand there knowing I am he, and you're meeting the truth in Gethsemane. That means regardless of the severity of the crisis confronting you, You have no desire or need to defend or preserve yourself, because yourself is the self of God. That is Gethsemane. And we who have not stood there, maybe more than once, are not ready for that mystical interval between resurrection and ascension, where even higher things are revealed. And so let us see then that this is the clarification of what is expected of us. We cannot make the mistake of Peter. We cannot make the mistake of Judas. We cannot make the mistake of mortal mind, religious mind, human mind, natural mind. We know that the divine self, being the only, that no other self is possible anywhere in the world. Everywhere you're looking at divine self, you're loving that divine self everywhere, and one day you're forced to prove your love, to stand on your love, not human love, but divine love, so that unlike Peter, who would defend the master himself, who has the power to summon legions, who has power over all flesh, willingly submits. I am he says. And if I am the one you seek, therefore let these others go. When he says, I am he and I submit, let these others go, if I'm the one you seek, he is telling you another secret. That only in the death of your corporeal sense do the disciples in you come alive into freedom. The divine qualities in you cannot be liberated while you are still unwilling to submit your corporeal sense to the acid test of non-existence. You cannot uphold your corporeal sense here and expect the divine qualities to burst through. Let them go, he says, if you want me. You want a man? Well, here's a man. Take the man. And this is the freedom of the divine qualities. The old is dying that the new may be born. The old man dies. The old concept of self dies that the new may walk the earth as the invisible Christ. When Jesus asks a band of soldiers to let the disciples go and take him, he is making way for the new understanding, the new age of spirit. He is sacrificing the nothingness of corporeality, that the allness of spirit may be understood.